Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, November 26th, 2019. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan is heading home, and Juba residents talk about what they want to see out of the 100-day extension.
Without security, we cannot do anything. So let the NPTC concentrate on the training of 45,000 troops.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United States has recalled its ambassador from South Sudan, according to the U.S. State Department, after the leaders of the former warring parties failed to agree on a unity government by the November 12th deadline. Ambassador Thomas Hushek will return for consultations, quote, as part of the re-evaluation of the U.S. relationship with the government of South Sudan, given the latest developments, end quote, said a U.S. State Department statement released yesterday. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tweeted that Washington would, in his words, work with the region to support efforts to achieve peace and a successful political transition in South Sudan. The South Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs put out a statement saying it was still communicating with the United States. Our position is still the same. We are still engaging with them, and we have a good relationship, said spokesman Maween McColl to the Reuters news agency. McColl said differences over the second extension of time to form a unity government should, in his words, not break our relations. The extension is meant to fully implement the peace agreement. Following the 5.5-year civil war, South Sudan President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar signed a peace agreement in September 2018 under enormous pressure from the United Nations, the United States, and regional governments to do so. Earlier this month, the parties agreed to give themselves 100 more days to form the unity government. The Trump administration responded by saying it was, quote, gravely disappointed, end quote. The conflict began after Kiir fired Machar as vice president, but under the revitalized deal, Machar is to return to the country to serve as first vice president once again in a unity government. Participants at a forum in Juba this week are calling on the parties to the revitalized peace agreement to prioritize the training of the unified forces within the 100-day extension of the pre-transitional period. The Tuesday public forum is aimed at providing reliable information on the 100-day extension. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
Participants at a forum in Juba are calling on the parties to the revitalized peace agreement to prioritize the training of the unified forces within the 100-day extension of the pre-transitional period. The Tuesday public forum is aimed at providing reliable information on the 100-day extension. About 100 people who attended the forum at the Landmark Hotel in Juba were sharing their expectations about the pre-transitional period, while others were seeking clarification on the purpose of the extension. Bishop Nicola Oling, a retired bishop from Christian Brotherhood Church, attended the public forum. He says if the deal collapses, South Sudan as a country will most likely disintegrate. Oling says the leaders of the various political groups must put aside their differences and focus on improving security across the country.
Without security, we cannot do anything. So let the NPTC concentrate on the training of 45,000 troops who will be part of the necessary force. And this should be deployed all over South Sudan, and especially in Juba here, to keep security. Then they can form a government and then discuss about the states or other issues which are there.
Cyril Nelson fled Kajukeji in 2016 during the conflict in Yei River State. He told the forum participants many South Sudanese are still suffering in refugee and IDP camps across the region. He says as far as he can tell, the parties have done little to implement tasks within the extended 100 days.
The problem we have is insecurity. So insecurity actually has to be a priority of everything. The most thing we like is security. When we look into aspect of peace, it even comes automatic. when there is security, people can move freely, people can go about their businesses. There is no cases, of armed robbery,
NPTC Deputy Chairperson Gabriel Changson says his office has worked out plans to implement the tasks. He says the budget presentation includes more than $60 million for security arrangements. He says South Sudanese are mostly concerned about security.
These activities of the security sector are not a one-time event. It is a process that will continue into the transition and probably beyond the transition. So let us do one thing at a time, and then we move on. So if we can deliver whatever number of forces we can deliver, in my opinion, that will help us to form the government, and all of us will be in that unity government.
Rajab Mohandis, Executive Director of the Organization for Responsive Governance, says the civil society groups have observed certain weaknesses in the peace deal's implementation.
If the resources do not reach them immediately, they cannot move on with these activities. So the first most important issue is the resources. The second is the issue of coordination, in our view, that the coordination, especially by NPTC, has not been adequate enough in facilitating these processes.
Rajab says civil society organizations will continue to monitor the peace implementation and offer recommendations to the parties to guide them on how to overcome obstacles. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Over the next 2 weeks, the world is marking 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. A new report from Afrobarometer shows domestic violence remains tolerated in many African countries. The report says about 1 in 4 African women and even more African men say men sometimes are justified in beating their wives. For VOA, Mavis Ochery in Washington has this report.
While 71% of Africans say it is never justified for a man to beat his wife, 28%, including 24% of women, see beating as sometimes or always justified. These findings from national surveys in 34 countries are part of a Pan-African profile analysis of a survey on gender equality. The new report by the Afrobarometer Public Opinion Survey Group examine issues such as gender equality, government performance on women's rights and gender gap in education and employment. Dominic Dryden is an assistant project manager for Afrobarometer and a co-author for the report on gender. She says acceptance of violence against women is particularly widespread in Central and West Africa and among respondents with no formal education. She says in Liberia and Gabon, up to 7 in 10 citizens tolerate domestic violence. However, not more than 1 in 20 respondents in Cabo Verde, Madagascar, Eswatini, and Malawi tolerate domestic violence. She says the polling showed that 64% of Africans across the continent thought their governments were doing fairly well on promoting equal rights and opportunity for women.
But of course, this again varies dramatically across the continent. So while 86% of Ugandans think that the government is doing well, only 41% of those in Gabon, for instance, feel the same way. Overall, there's a generally positive view.
Afrobarometer survey indicates that public opinion on domestic violence may be changing in Africa. A 2005 survey by the International Perspective on Sexual and Reproductive Health in 7 nations found that 36% of women in Malawi approved of wife beating in at least some circumstances. And in Mali, 89% of women thought it could be justified. The survey was done between 1999 and 2001 in Benin, Ethiopia, Malawi, Mali, Rwanda, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. In both surveys, respondents with no formal education made up 41% were significantly more likely to endorse wife beating than those with primary, secondary, or post-secondary schooling made of 23% to 25%.
I think that really improving education systems on the continent, but also education around gender equality and domestic violence would really help shift citizens' perceptions on whether this is okay or not.
African countries are not alone in tolerating reflecting spousal abuse. A world value survey done between 2010 and 2014 shows that in 29 countries, one-third of men said it was acceptable for a husband to beat his spouse. In 19 countries, a third of women said beatings by husbands could be acceptable. The study is led by an international network of researchers based in Stockholm. It showed that about two-thirds of women in India tolerate spousal abuse, as well as large number of women in countries such as China, Iraq, Peru, the Philippines, and Uzbekistan. Afrobarometer leads a nonpartisan research network in conducting attitude surveys on democracy, governance, economic conditions, and related issues across Africa. The special model on gender equality was carried out in partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Reporting for the VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Some big businesswomen in Africa say the continent will not achieve the development it envisages unless stereotypes that underestimate women are eliminated in business society. The call came during the three-day Global Gender Summit 2019 in Kigali to tackle a $42 billion female financing gap. For VOA,
Paulo Teka is a 43-year-old South African entrepreneur who co-founded the IDF Capital in Sandton in Johannesburg. The company provides financial and non-financial products and support to unlock the value of women's small and medium enterprises. She says she realized it's very difficult for an African woman to start a business without leaning on a man's shoulder, which she says keeps the continent undeveloped.
You walk into a room, people don't really think that you've got a really commercially viable opportunity to talk about. I have found that the market, for instance, assumes that women run micro-businesses that are slow-growing businesses.
Economic experts warn that if African leaders want to really nurture women, they need to fund activities that employ many of them. The African Development Bank estimates 75% of African farmers are women. The International Finance Corporation, IFC, says that of the total financing gap for women in Africa, an estimated $15.6 billion is in agriculture. Akinwumi Adesina, president of African Development Bank, FDB, assures that it is doing what it can to fill the gap.
I think when you get land in the hands of women, it can transform things. That's why the African Development Bank, we are doing quite a lot to, on agriculture. We're spending $25 billion over 10 years and making sure all we do in agriculture is directed towards empowering these women.
There is a hope that more initiatives to develop women and enhance gender equality in the business can be adopted as leaders from government, development institutions, the private sector, civil society, and academia have gathered for this year's Global Gender Summit, which aims to make women's voices heard. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame says Africa needs to move from rhetoric to practice, from words to deeds.
Therefore, learn, do, change, and measure, so that we are able to tell where we have come from and where we are at the present and where we could be going forward in the future.
The summit, co-hosted by the FDB and Rwanda, is being held in Africa for the first time. It has attracted more than 800 participants that include heads of state, first ladies, and other prominent gender activist key players. One of its objectives is to share best practices and mobilize investments to speed up gender equality and women empowerment around the globe. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. New efforts are underway to fight dengue fever. Find out more when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what traditional medicines do you take, if any?
I don't take any traditional medicine as a young, active African. I think I'm strong enough. I use water and more of the fruits. I think my parents do a lot of traditional medicine.
I haven't taken traditional medicine yet. I hope I never do, because I'm biased about traditional medicine. I think people put in so much spiritual things to make sure that their medicine works, so I've not given it a try.
Yeah, I take, but I don't know the biological names in English. Yeah, but I take that is this Mururuza. I don't know how they call it in English. And the aloe vera tigaji. Yeah, I take Mururuza and the aloe vera for treatment of malaria. Very good. Most myself, I use it for my stomach.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And it's time now for our Tuesday health segment. And today we're talking about dengue fever. Amid a global surge of infections with dengue and fears that climate change will make it worse, an international alliance of researchers presented new data showing that the disease fell dramatically in communities in Indonesia, Vietnam, Brazil, and Australia. The reduction in cases occurred in communities where researchers had released lab-grown mosquitoes carrying Wolbachia, a bacteria that prevents mosquitoes from transmitting dengue when they bite humans. Reporter Mavis Ochery spoke with Professor Cameron Simmons, Director of Impact Assessment and an expert in epidemiology of dengue at the World Mosquito Program, to learn more about Wolbachia.
So our work began in Australia in 2011, and we've deployed our method, which is called Wolbachia, into mosquito populations in northern Australia, protecting 350,000 people. And we've essentially eliminated dengue transmission as a public health problem in northern Australia now over the last 8 or 9 years. In Indonesia, we've done a study in the city of Yogyakarta, where in one community that was treated with the Wolbachia method, we've seen a 76% reduction in dengue incidence compared to neighbouring areas that were not treated with Wolbachia. Over in Brazil, we've seen a reduction in dengue and chikungunya incidents in locations where Wolbachia has been deployed. And so over in different countries, over different time periods, we're seeing the same trend that Wolbachia is delivering public health benefits by reducing the incidence of dengue and chikungunya.
So can you tell me how the reduction in dengue cases occurred?
Yeah, so our intervention called Wolbachia is a bacteria, and we spread that bacteria through the mosquito population in each community. And that bacteria makes the mosquitoes unable to transmit these viruses. If the mosquito can't transmit the virus, they can't give the virus to humans, and they can't make people sick. And so we're not reducing the mosquito population. We're changing the nature of the mosquito population so that they're no longer able to transmit these diseases.
Tell me more about the reduction in Indonesia.
This is a community in 7 neighbourhoods in the city of Yogyakarta in central Java, where Wolbachia was deployed, a population of about 65,000 people. And we deployed Wolbachia there 2.5 years ago, and we've been watching to look at dengue case notifications in the Wolbachia-treated neighbourhood and comparing it to very similar neighbourhoods nearby that were not treated with Wolbachia. And so what we've seen over the last 2.5 years is that the Wolbachia-treated neighbourhoods have 76% fewer dengue cases than neighbouring untreated neighbourhoods. And so this is therefore giving us a strong signal of public health benefit using this method. And very importantly, the method is self-sustaining, so that once Wolbachia is present in the mosquitoes, it remains in the mosquitoes for many years and probably decades, and so very likely provides that public health benefit for many years after the initial deployment of the Wolbachia mosquitoes.
Does this highlight a potential approach to fight dengue and related mosquito-borne diseases on a global scale?
Yes. This Wolbachia also has an effect on the chikungunya virus, which is also transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Wolbachia also has an effect on the Zika virus, and so these interventions should protect communities from these three diseases. There are other vector-borne diseases that are important, like Japanese encephalitis or indeed malaria, but those diseases are transmitted by other species of mosquito, not the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Our method is specifically focused to the Aedes aegypti mosquito. And so this particular tool is very focused at the moment around dengue, chikungunya, and the Zika virus prevention.
Now, are there updates on a trial with a new dengue vaccine?
Yeah, correct. So there's a company called Takeda that has announced some phase three vaccine results of a new candidate dengue vaccine. And so that particular vaccine still has to finish its journey through the clinical trial development phase, and so is not yet a licensed vaccine and not available to buy in any country. I think this year is, especially this year across Asia, Southeast Asia, it's been a very big year for dengue transmission. A very large numbers of cases, a large number of deaths. Dengue's emerging as a very big problem in Brazil this year, and so I think the tools that we've used to try and stop the spread of these mosquito-borne diseases over several decades, I think we're seeing that those tools simply fail to stop epidemics of dengue fever, and we desperately need new tools like the Wolbachia method that we're using.
That was Cameron Simmons, an expert in the epidemiology of dengue at the World Mosquito Program. He was speaking with VOA's Mavis Ochery. Cameroon has warned opposition political parties against any acts that may jeopardize its local council and parliamentary elections in February. The warning comes after opposition party leader Maurice Kamto, who claims President Paul Biya stole last year's election, called for a boycott of the polls. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says the government will not tolerate any acts that disturb the free conduct of February's local and parliamentary elections.
Politicians specialize in hate speech, manipulation and provocation, as well as defiance of state authority should know that they will face the heavy arm of the law in case of any misconduct. I want to make it very clear. Promoters of political parties will henceforth be held accountable in case of any disruption of public order related to political rallies.
This warning came after opposition leader Maurice Kamto, at a Monday press conference, announced a boycott of the February polls. Kamto had planned to run for office but changed his mind and accused authorities of trying to destroy his party, the Cameroon Renaissance Movement, CRM.
Organiser des élections au Cameroun aujourd'hui.
Kamto says he does not doubt that the objective of what he calls the illegitimate Yaoundé regime, in collaboration with the Ministry of Territorial Administration and the different state services, is to destroy the CRM party. He says they want to eliminate the party from the political map and terrorize the Cameroonian people to keep the ruling class in power. Kamto accuses Nji of scheming with Cameroon's elections management body ELECAM to fix last year's presidential election to re-elect long-serving President Paul Biya. The election authorities and Nji deny the polls were anything but free and fair. Kamto said his boycott was based on electoral laws that favor Biya's ruling party, the Cameroon's People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, and the ongoing separatist conflict. His call for an election boycott received mixed views from opposition supporters like 30-year-old Justin Alega.
Le professeur Maurice Kamto a trahi ses partisans. Je pense que le professeur est en train de plonger.
He says Kamto has betrayed his supporters and is plugging his political party into the group of losers, because when they are not represented at the National Assembly, says Alega, they will no longer have a platform for their voices to be heard. He says if Kamto wants to change Cameroon's laws, he says, are bad, he should do everything to be voted in as a lawmaker. 31-year-old Kamto supporter Annabel Mbi, however, says he supports the decision to boycott the elections.
There is no need going for an election when you know that your victory will be stolen, and often when you protest, you are arrested. This is a dictatorship.
Political analyst at the University of Yaoundé, Divine Kwe, says the opposition MRC should fight for political change from within, as the new parliament's mandate will last 5 years.
The meaning is that for the next 5 years, MRC will only make their voices heard through street protest, because they will not participate at decision-making circles directly. Kamto should have gone in for the elections and tried to effect changes from within parliament.
Kamto called on Monday for other opposition parties, civil society and religious groups to join in boycotting the elections. Territorial Administration Minister Nje warned he would arrest Kamto or anyone else who staged unauthorized protests against the elections. Kamto and more than 400 of his supporters spent 9 months in prison for street protests over the October 2018 presidential election results. Authorities released Kamto in October for a national dialogue on the separatist conflict in Cameroon, but he was banned from holding public events. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Zimbabwe government is coming to grips with the impact of extreme discontent over the economic downturn as security forces vent their frustration in what observers say is a possible harbinger of things to come. Adi Gondo has more on the story.
Without warning, a member of the Presidential Guard pumped 30 shots from his AK rifles into the air near State House, causing pandemonium before colleagues disarmed him as he was reloading. The soldier was quoted as complaining of his inability to survive in a nearly dead economy while men in suits are living large. Observers say the incident is not surprising, given that the security forces, especially the junior ranks, are not spared from the economic meltdown in the country. Mbuso Fuzwayo, a political analyst, calls the incident a bad omen.
Because if the morale is low in the barracks, the security of the country is compromised. So I think that is a turning point, that the masses are suffering, the military is suffering, the junior officers. And if they can combine forces with the civilians, those in leadership are exposed.
Defense Minister Opam Chinguri Kashiri recently appraised legislators on the dire state of the military's finances. The Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Defense and Home Affairs heard that soldiers and police officers' morale had hit rock bottom due to shortages of food and uniform. Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube 2 weeks ago announced the security sector would get a little more than 10% of the $63.8 billion 2020 budget in a move to raise morale and avert hunger and poor resourcing in the armed forces. But experts say as long as the currency is losing value amid hyperinflation, that won't be enough to address the plight of the security forces, let alone the rest of the populace.
And that is reporter Andy Gondo. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Reconciliation by Kebas.
Yeah. The homeboy Kebas and Leviticus Levi.
Reconciliation.
You already know we're talking about reconciliation. Yeah. That's all we need. That's all we're praying for. Leave it, tell him, say.
Max Lever is.
Umonfikeli manina masakin, lakini na mistakalseni. Umonfikeli manina deifin, lakini na inu iman. Reconcileso, ya uri na deru. Reconcileso, so da uri.
This mulubari kujaje dip fi hila bitana umbari zamanuja fishari ligolo white kid omega soban tuwali tarau deje run bitau humba godu sawa kulu yom the kebas for levy friendship town biga tala gowi the berenga te sharwai who osli gowi lakini omi na yam shitan daka fi ras bitam gada bukuat lahadi lubari has no part to call a friend.
Forgiveness while I'm preaching,
I have a strong desire burning like a fire. Let us take time, making we can take it higher. This is a generation to change the nation through peace and reconciliation.
Yes, yeah.
Umonfikeli manina masakin.
We've been listening to Kabas with the song Reconciliation. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles this evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Reconciliation, Mabzol Taban, Mabzol Dei, Figi Dam Tala, Mabzol Meskin, Mabzol Ganyan, Figi Dam Tala, Mabzol Taban, Mabzol Dei.